Next case is 07-1157, Disciplinary Counsel versus George Matthew Parker. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Mr. Caligiuri. I'm George Johnson. I have the honor of representing the Honorable Judge George Parker. We are here today on our objections to the report and recommendations of the board. We have filed four objections, one to the failure of the board to find that Judge Parker's diagnosed narcissistic personality disorder, which, unless it's objectionable to one of you, I'll just refer to as NPD, was not a mitigating factor to be considered in the award of sanctions in this case. Second, the panel's refusal to accept disciplinary counsel's stipulation that Mr. Parker had cooperated in these proceedings. Third, that instead, they found that Judge Parker exhibited a lack of cooperation and that that was an aggravating factor, along with the submission of false evidence and the refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. And lastly, the sanction that was recommended by the board. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The NPD issue is pretty straightforward. The testimony and the report of Dr. Beach, who's the independent psychiatrist that was retained by the board to examine Mr. Parker, are set forth in the briefs. And while I'm happy to address questions as to that, I'd like to address the other aggravation and mitigation issues
Counsel,
in a little more detail.
Just one question. It's a new disorder to me. Is it common? Widely recognized?
The only information on that that's in the record is that Judge Beach testified that it was a diagnosis that's recognized under the DSM-4, which is the diagnostic, I think they're up to four, the diagnostic manual that's used by psychiatrists and psychologists. So in that sense, I believe it is acknowledged and a widely accepted diagnosis. There wasn't any other testimony about it than that. Judge Parker cooperated with these proceedings, and his cooperation starts before the proceeding ever was initiated. He self-reported. As you know from the recommendations, the report and recommendations, there was quite a battle in Mason, Ohio between Judge Parker, the police chief, and some others. And the prosecutor brought a list of instances that he thought that Judge Parker had violated the ethics codes to Judge Parker. Judge Parker put together a massive amount of information and self-reported. So he started this proceeding himself. He stipulated to 215 factual paragraphs, and they weren't all housekeeping paragraphs, as I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. Some of those stipulations were used against him during cross-examination because he stipulated to facts that did not match his recollection. He thought one thing happened. It was his testimony under oath. It was his testimony in response to the letters of inquiry. After reviewing different pieces of evidence for different facts, the audio tapes, the videotapes, the affidavits of other people involved, hearing the testimony of other people involved, he stipulated to facts that didn't jibe with his recollection. So there's 215 paragraphs of factual stipulations, and they are not insignificant by any stretch. We stipulated to 85 exhibits, which was all the exhibits except two letters from disciplinary counsel, our responses to two letters of inquiry, and the exhibits that were marked at the hearing. Stipulation 39, Judge Parker waived his notice and consented to the addition of the allegation of a violation of Canon 4 in count two of the complaint. Could have fought about it, didn't fight about it. Disciplinary counsel said, we feel like we need to add this. Judge Parker said, fine. He stipulated that his actions in count seven were violations of Canon 2 and 3B4. Now, count seven contained allegations relative to seven different cases and fact sets. And the allegations against Judge Parker, the reason they were lumped was that the unifying allegation was that he had acted intemperately, that he had been discourteous and arrogant from the bench, and he stipulated that his actions in count seven violated the canons. He cooperated with Dr. Beach, who's the independent psychiatrist that the board elected. We did not make the board put an order on. Judge Parker agreed that he would waive the doctor-patient relationship, he would give the doctor any information he wanted, including documents, and that the doctor was free to testify and so forth. And Dr. Beach testified that Judge Parker was cooperative during their sessions and was in fact trying to be helpful. And disciplinary counsel stipulated to cooperation. Now, instead of accepting that stipulation.
Chris, as you know, the disciplinary counsel contests that assertion that he was cooperative because of his, what they referred to as his lies and his contradictions and so forth, that's not cooperation.
That's what I hear now that the brief is filed. That wasn't what we stipulated to. I want to point to two other cases, and that's, Chief Justice, that's the heart of what I want to talk about, is these findings of lies and misrepresentations. In Judge O'Neill's case, failure to cooperate was not listed as an aggravating factor. In Judge Medley's case, where Judge Medley was found guilty of dishonesty, fraud, and deceit, and where there is a notation in this court's opinion on that case that Judge Medley specifically contested the board's finding that he had lied and made misrepresentations during the hearing, not only was non-cooperation not an aggravating factor, he was given cooperation as a mitigating factor. So we've got two cases with different facts, with less cooperation on their face, where the respondents were given cooperation as a mitigating factor. We turn to the aggravating factors. Cooperation doesn't just come off the table as a mitigating factor. Non-cooperation is an aggravating factor. Refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. He stipulates to count seven, which is 10 counts, 10 separate cases. He admitted during day three that there were two counts, there were two fact sets in count three. He admitted that one of them he had acted improperly. He admitted he had acted improperly in count four and five. And on count two, he agreed that he should have informed defense counsel that he had been on the ride-along. His testimony was he didn't remember it, but it was established as a fact in the stipulations, and he admitted that that conduct was wrong.
Mr. Johnson, do you think it was because at the hearing that Mr. Parker attempted to back away from these stipulations that caused this change of cooperation? Because I was struck by the fact, as you point out in count seven, where, you know, some people may be arguing, well, this is personality, this is not quite as bad as it is. We have stipulations that, yes, there's a violation, and yet later on, the argument of lack of cooperation appears to be because of statements he made at the hearing.
I think that's true. And they have taken his truthful testimony about what his recollection is and held it in contrast to the stipulations and found that he was not telling the truth. Now, I don't know who's going to enter into stipulations after this case, because if I remember that I did something on a Tuesday, but looking at the evidence objectively, I look at letters and telephone calls and I hear two people testify about it and I say, I should stipulate that that happened on a Wednesday, because that's the conclusion I'm going to reach. I'm going to force a board to listen to all this testimony and look at this evidence, and I think I'm remembering it wrong, so I'm going to stipulate. That's what happened to George Parker, and those stipulations were stuck to him. Specifically, in the Gadbury case, Gadbury's the woman who was held in contempt. The audio tape from the court doesn't record what she says as she's reaching for the door. She raises her hand to get the judge's attention. The judge says words to the effect of, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want to hear from you, I'd like you to leave, don't say anything else. The videotape shows she's opening the door, reaching for the door. The audio tape picks up nothing. Judge Parker, she says something under her breath, she admits that. Judge Parker recalls, he understands that she has uttered a profanity, and he reacts by saying, I told you not to say anything else, I'm holding you in contempt. She testifies, she's set to testify, that she said, I can't believe this, under her breath. Now, so Judge Parker's written that she uttered a profanity in his letter response to letter of inquiry. He's testified to that at his deposition. Disciplinary counsel says, hey, she's going to come and testify. She's going to testify. She said, I can't believe this. Judge Parker says, fine. I don't think what she said is significant. I think the fact that I told her to leave and not say anything and she spoke again is sufficient for me to hold her in contempt.
Well, counsel, whether she uttered a profanity or whether she's under her breath muttered, I can't believe this is happening, the actual behavior of the judge at that particular time gives rise to concern about his role as a judge.
I understand exactly what you're saying.
And now you're saying that every time he got caught with hard, concrete evidence, he backs away from his initial recollections or actually very concrete statements and says, I'm caught, well, I guess I better agree to the stipulation then. I mean, that's what the pattern appears to be here. Not upon reflection, I may have been wrong. Somebody might have a better memory than I. I'm going to back down and give the benefit of the doubt, so to speak. I'm going to acquiesce to the stipulations.
I hear what you're saying. Can I bring another example to your attention?
All right.
With regard to Ambrose, who was the ride-along, the person that was arrested in the middle of the night. Judge Parker's awakened from his sleep. He doesn't drive himself to the courthouse because he doesn't have his contact lenses in. There's some question about whether he asked to go along on the ride and so forth. What the panel focuses on, under the category of respondents' misrepresentations and inconsistencies, at page 31 of the report is this. Quote, in his first answer, and the panel's talking about his responses to disciplinary counsel's first letter of inquiry, in his first answer, respondent stated that while defendant was booked at the Warren County Jail, he stayed in the car. However, respondent later stipulated he was in the Sally Port while defendant was booked and that he signed the commitment order, which appears in the record. If you look at Exhibit 79, which is the first answer, and you read the two sentences before the sentences that the panel quotes, it says this, quote, during the trip to serve the warrant, Judge Parker fell asleep in the front seat of the police car. He was awakened by the car door being opened and an individual being placed in the back seat. Judge Parker went back to sleep during the transit to Warren County Jail and was awakened there when the officer and the rear seat occupant left the vehicle. Judge Parker stayed in the car and the officer returned, presumably after booking to return Judge Parker to his home. His recollection was Ambrose was stuck in the back seat of the car he was in. Didn't happen that way. Officer Fain said, no, he was in a different car. They were never in the same car. Parker doesn't have his contact lenses in. His first testimony, his first recollection out of the box was this guy's in the back seat. Now, even without contact lenses, if I'm in close personal proximity with somebody, I have to be pretty blind to be able to say, you know, I didn't recognize him 5 weeks later. So Parker's first recollection is not to his benefit. And the panel ignores that. They ignore the fact that when Officer Fain said, no, they were in two different cars, Parker said, okay, I'll stipulate to that. Fain was wide awake. I was not wide awake. So what the panel does is they pick up inconsistencies that they want to use against Parker. They don't pick up inconsistencies in the rest of the testimony. And there are some other glaring problems in the Ambrose case. Officer Fain testified, the police officer who made the arrest, said he was troubled by the fact that Parker went on the ride-along. He said he told Peeler, who's the prosecutor, shortly after the ride-along, the judge went with. Is that legitimate? Is that okay? Peeler testifies, and Fain was there at the hearing that day, on the sentencing hearing, when Judge Parker accepted the plea. Peeler was there. Peeler says, no, Fain told me that after the hearing, and I told it to defense counsel after the hearing. So Fain says I told him well before. Peeler says he told me after. Peeler says he told the defense counsel. The defense counsel says he was unaware of it until disciplinary counsel raised it. None of that's mentioned. Are any of those people lying? No. It's an example of the fact that this was a night 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and recollections vary. The only person whose recollections are turned into lies and misrepresentations are Parker's.
Counsel, it's the focus of the claim that he was uncooperative based on what his initial statements were contrasted with what he stipulated to, or is it that at the hearing he was backing away from his stipulations?
I think there are two distinct things being said. One is that he...
Because that would be different.
If
you stipulate and then you come to the hearing, I mean, stipulations mean that neither side has to prepare.
That's right.
On these things. And if you show up at the hearing and suddenly throw the panel into a tizzy because respondent is saying, that's wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong, then the panel's stuck with, well, now what do we do? Do we continue this?
That's an excellent point. And the first thing I want to tell you is the panel found two different things. With regard to the stipulations, they said that he tried to back away from stipulations. But he didn't come in and change his testimony from the stipulations. Disciplinary counsel was allowed to ask him, here's your first letter of inquiry, and it's different than the stipulations, trying to impeach his credibility. And I objected to that, and it was allowed. So we did exactly what you said, Justice Pfeiffer. We came into court thinking the stipulations are matters that have been put to bed. And he was successfully cross-examined. You know, when you say to the guy, well, you testified to this, and now you stipulated to this, and he says, you know, that what I testified to is still my recollection.
So you were at the hearing, at
yes.
the panel hearing, and your position on his behalf and his position was, I've stipulated to this, and I'm not trying to take any of that away.
That's right. We specifically objected to using the stipulations and his previous testimony or responses to letters of inquiry to impeach him. And so, I think I've blown through all my time.
Red light.
May I conclude briefly?
Why don't you save it for rebuttal? I'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Caligiuri.
Thank you. May it please the court. Joseph Caligiuri, Assistant Disciplinary Counsel for Relator. I do intend to address each of Mr. Johnson's arguments, but I first would like to state and note that this is critical. The respondent was found to have violated 31 violations of the Code of Judicial Conduct and the Code of Professional Responsibility. In addition, the board found the presence of six aggravating factors, some of which were discussed, but most notably that the respondent submitted false statements, false evidence, and engaged in other deceptive practices in the disciplinary process. There is one line in the board's report that captures the essence of the respondent's behavior throughout this proceeding, including today. And I quote, after a close and careful inspection of the record, the panel can only conclude that the respondent intentionally misrepresented facts and was untruthful in his testimony.
Okay, you just said an interesting thing. You said including today. So what has been misrepresented to us?
That there is now justification for the earlier misrepresentations that were so flagrant and blatant in the responses to the letters of inquiry. Respondent, through his brief, is now attempting to ask this panel to find that his narcissistic personality disorder contributed to the shift in testimony, which was laid out in his brief. That simply wasn't the case. There was no support for that proposition in the record. And it's relator's contention.
So when you say including today, you're referring to what they said in the briefs rather than what was said here in oral argument.
Well, what was said here in oral argument also is the intent was to say that there are reasons for this. The only reason for the misrepresentations.
This being, I'm troubled by pronouns.
The shift in the testimony, how the panel characterized the shift as being deceptive. The only reason.
And did I misunderstand the argument to be that we entered into stipulations with disciplinary counsel and then got cross-examined about the discrepancies between the stipulations and earlier matters, and that he objected to that?
That was respondent's position, that we were not allowed to impeach the respondent's credibility. But the respondent put himself in this position. He fabricated responses to the letters of inquiries solely to avoid discipline. This isn't a situation.
Okay, but then you move beyond that to stipulations. Stipulations are to say, okay, we know what everybody's got. We know what you've got. You know what we've got. Here's what we're going to agree to. Once you do that, should you be cross-examined at the hearing over what you've stipulated to?
In light of the fact that he submitted false statements before, certainly. And my position on stipulations is that if you're stipulating that this happened, it happened. And he stipulated, for instance, in the Naomi Gadberry matter, that this woman stated, "I can't believe this." In his first answer to the letter of inquiry, his first response to the letter of inquiry, he clearly stated, "The reason why I held her in contempt was because she directed a profanity directly at him." And it was a vulgar profanity.
Okay.
Now he
were they on notice that, was the judge on notice that when you get, you've got all these stipulations, but when we get to the hearing, we're going to take the stipulations, match them up with what you said earlier, and prove that you're a liar?
Well, they were on notice in the fact that that happened. I don't think there was any note, there was no notice before to the panel that Relator intended to cross-examine the respondent on some of the discrepancies. But it wasn't just the stipulations. The respondent himself, during the testimony, recanted some of his, he tried to get out of some of his stipulations. He did that in the Ambrose matter. He did that in the Gadberry matter, just as two examples.
Well, if you're cross-examining someone and you're saying to them, "You stipulated to this, but in your earlier testimony you've said why," and they said, "Well, I still remember it as why, but I'm stipulating to X because I've looked at the evidence," that's kind of sandbagging them, aren't they? I mean, you're taking something that he's looked through the evidence and agreed he was wrong, and you're using a prior statement as, "Ah, but you're lying," rather than maybe you've really looked through the evidence and agreed you're wrong.
But he never did agree that he was wrong. At the hearing, he kept retracting and going back to his answer. If he didn't think that it happened, then he shouldn't have stipulated, and
well,
he shouldn't
have.
Well,
you can cross-examine someone to shift them back into that position pretty darn easy if they've got a stipulation and a prior inconsistent statement. I mean, you got them trapped which way you go.
Well, I mean, and again, I go back to the point that the respondent put himself in this position. He initially fabricated responses to avoid discipline. It's his responsibility. And the fact that he's trying to say that he was sandbagged, this is another example of him failing to appreciate his misconduct and accept responsibility for what he has done.
Well, I think Mr. Johnson makes a valid point, though. If someone does then stipulate to contrary to the initial position they took, there's not going to be any incentive for anybody to ever do that again.
And I would go back again. I would agree that that could be a disincentive, but I think the point that needs to be made here is that the respondent submitted these answers knowing they were false solely to avoid discipline. He then wants to come in and stipulate to something that is completely different to his answer. And then when he testifies, he not only does he contradict his stipulations, he adds new facts like he did in the Jane Doe matter, reasons for taking the picture, like he did in the 911 matter.
I'd like to move you to the affirmative defense of his mental disorder. Was there any testimony that he did not have this disorder?
No.
In fact, his physician even agreed, did he not?
Yes, his physician concurred with Dr. Beach's report.
And there's a prior case in which we lay out the four tests, so to speak, and two of them being a sustained period of treatment and a prognosis that he can return to competent practice of law. And in the brief, since the attorney Johnson didn't get to argue this in the brief, they argue that those two points were proven. It's my understanding that your argument is not necessary that they did not consider this at all in mitigation, but they did in fact consider it in mitigation, but still, because he's not reached point three and four successfully, have given a stiffer sentence than if he had. Is that a fair statement of your position?
If I could just break it up a bit, Justice Stratton. Part of that is accurate in that it is our belief that he did not establish the third and fourth prongs of the test.
And we've had a lot of people who still are mentally ill when they come before us, and we might have disbarred them had they not had that as a defense, whereas we drop it to perhaps an indefinite suspension to give them a chance to recover. So we don't say there's no mitigation at all for a mental illness, do we? I don't think our
opinion
is
No, not at all. Not at all. What I'm saying is that the panel and the board found that he just simply did not meet the criteria. And the reason for that was that the respondent didn't call Dr. Beach. The panel injected Dr. Beach into the proceedings and they questioned Dr. Beach. It was the panel's witness. But the panel and the board did give respondent mitigation credit for his treatment, which was completely appropriate. So they did not find that his narcissistic personality disorder was a mitigating factor under 10B2G, but they did find that his treatment was mitigation. So we end up at the same place. We later would submit that the sanction is appropriate because it takes into account his treatment. In fact, the board stated that but for his improved conduct on the third day of the hearing, they would have considered an indefinite suspension.
Is the basis of the non-cooperation this difference between the earlier statements and the stipulated statements, or does it transcend that?
I think it's fair to say that that is the basis, and it's simply because, again, going back to this most critical point, the respondent of his own volition submitted false statements to avoid discipline.
Yes, I think I understand the argument, and I'm just wondering that that results in a lack of cooperation, which was found against the respondent in this instance.
Right, and I think that's appropriate. We've had many cases where this court has held that lying in a disciplinary action has consequences.
Like have there been other cases, to your knowledge, where a prior statement made has been utilized after that party agrees to a stipulated statement as a evidence of no cooperation?
I believe that we had similar situations or issues in the Judge Medley case, where his initial responses were X, his testimony was Y, but I don't remember the specifics enough to comment if that specific issue was addressed.
Thank you.
Counsel, directing your attention to the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, is it my recollection that it was found to be present and in part can be used as a rationale for how this individual comported himself on the bench and off the bench, but not as a, this is a function of this mental illness and this explains everything. Now that we've diagnosed him, everything suddenly becomes clear here. It's not an excuse, and it's certainly not viewed, based on my reading of the file, of a total mitigation to what's going on here.
No, you're exactly right. What the board stated and what Dr. Beach stated was that the narcissistic personality disorder in part contributed to the misconduct. And even if you were to accept that as mitigation, which I'm submitting that the board did accept mitigation, but it was for the treatment, that wouldn't absolve the misconduct here. Nor does it explain the respondent's conscious attempt to mislead relator to avoid discipline. Even if you take the stipulations out of it, we're still left with the fact that the respondent intentionally attempted to mislead relator in order to avoid discipline.
I'd like to have you review for us the, let's get off the dishonesty and all that dispute. His conduct as a judge, that I'm concerned about that, the way he acted, regardless of whether he had a personality disorder or whatever. Review for us, if you will, his conduct, the conduct which I find to be very offensive. Person puts on a black robe and they become a bit of a tyrant with using their authority as a judge. Could you review for us and quickly, because it's in the briefs, obviously, but the conduct in which he engaged as a judge that we should find offensive?
The conduct, Mr. Chief Justice Moyer, was horrific and offensive. There are situations in this case, as I stated, he violated 31 canons, or I'm sorry, there were 31 violations of the Code of Judicial Conduct and Code of Professional Responsibility. There was an A4 violation involving dishonesty. Just to give you one example, the respondent, in a heated moment, dialed 911 to call for a sheriff to come to his chambers in a non-emergency situation, a lapse in judgment. The respondent totally complicated the matter and now tried to cover it up because a few days after this incident happened, the newspaper published a report that the respondent dialed 911 in a non-emergency situation. And it stated in there that criminal charges may be filed. In response to that article, the respondent actually called the defense attorney at home and attempted to coerce this defense attorney into supporting respondent's false version of the events and not only to support that version, but to blame it on a young assistant prosecutor that practiced in his courtroom.
The attorney, the defense attorney, testified to that. That's in the record.
That's right. Exactly in the record. Another example, obviously, is the Miss Naomi Gadberry matter. This woman raised her hand in court to ask a question, and the respondent not only threw her out of court, and the video evidence is extremely clear. She was complying with that order. She got up, gathered her belongings, and started to walk out. She turned around and respondent immediately held her in contempt of court. She stated, "I didn't say anything." And he said, "You just did." If she had uttered that profanity, he would have stated it in his journal entry, which he didn't. And he ended up sentencing her to 24 hours in jail. In another instance, the Melody Graham matter, that's an instance that is so similar to our decision in Columbus Bar Association versus Cleary. The respondent had an agenda that day, and he used the tools of his office to accomplish that goal, and that was to keep a pregnant woman in his courtroom subject to his jurisdiction, despite the prosecutor and the defense attorney's request to waive the preliminary hearing. And he stated on the record, "I should have accepted your waiver, but I couldn't do it, not in good conscience." And then at the hearing, he testified that the reason that he didn't accept the waiver was because it didn't comply with Crim Rule 5, despite the fact that that was the same waiver that he used in all previous preliminary hearings. It was a complete fabrication aimed at avoiding discipline. If that's a substantial...
Was there any explanation to why he kept her in the courtroom?
I'm sorry?
Was there any explanation as to why he kept her there?
There was a discussion on the record about trying to resolve the matter as a misdemeanor. There was a discussion off the record between attorneys that the respondent had some concern that she was pregnant and would be using drugs because the charge involved theft of a credit card, which is a felony, and the possession of drug paraphernalia, which was a misdemeanor. So the respondent was trying to get both counsel to agree to resolve this case as a misdemeanor, and he wanted it in his courtroom so that he can control this defendant. And he even stated to her, "Your rights, as far as I'm concerned, your rights are subordinate. You're no longer ingesting for one, you're ingesting for two." So his rationale for keeping this matter in municipal court was clear, and then when he got to the hearing, he told a different story.
I'm interested in the recommendation of the board, which I guess it does require some indication before he would return to the practice that he's competent to do that. But I guess I'm concerned that where someone has a personality disorder like this and prints not very treatable, the evidence is that he's not very treatable, that we permit a person to come back into the practice, and whether or not he becomes a judge again, I don't know, but without our full review, our indefinite suspension review that we give to attorneys, as you know, who we want to take a closer look at them before we give them return their license to them. That doesn't seem to be, that's not included in this recommendation from the board. Can you speak to that?
Well, there are a number of intricate factors that the board included in the report, and one was that the respondent continue with treatment, and that he be, and I believe before he be allowed back in, that he present this evidence that he would be fit. And I know this court, in other cases, has issued sanctions stating that it may be appropriate at times for someone, even on indefinite term suspension, to apply, so to speak, for reinstatement, like we have done in indefinite suspension cases. But it's definitely a concern. And this is, we can't ignore the fact that he has this problem, and certainly he does, if respondent's argument is to be accepted that the dishonesty and the shift in testimony are a result of his disorder, then that dishonesty is always going to pose a risk to future clients. I would just like to conclude with some language from a case that was decided just 7 months ago in Disciplinary Counsel versus Judge Cox, and I would state that in this instance, even if we took out the stipulations, we're still left with respondents' dishonesty upon receipt of the letters of inquiry. And this court stated that a member of the judiciary would submit dishonest or misleading information during a disciplinary investigation to cover up his misuse of judicial authority is an affront to the entire legal and disciplinary system. Based upon the pervasive misconduct coupled with his dishonesty, We respectfully request that this court adopt the board's recommended sanction of an 18-month suspension with 6 months' stay.
Thank you, Mr. Caligiuri. Mr. Johnson, you used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mayor.
You don't have to.
I wish I could bargain you out of 3 minutes. I would like to direct the panel's attention to two things. In response to Mr. Caligiuri's statement that in the Graham matter, Judge Parker came to court that day with an agenda. Look at the transcript, which is page 40 on the third page, and you will see that it's the prosecutor who brings this up and asks for the judge to get involved. The second thing I want to bring to your attention is the panel on page 32 of its report states one of Judge Parker's responses to a letter of inquiry and makes a statement, this claim is patently untrue. That's the panel. I ask you to look at that on page 32 of the report and compare it. The report is Exhibit 80. Compare it to Exhibit 52, and you will see that it is exquisitely true. This panel got off the track somewhere, and they started painting with a very broad brush. We have not said anywhere that Judge Parker is a model judge. He has narcissistic personality disorder. Our requested sanction is the 18-month suspension that was recommended, but that he be allowed to come back into the practice when he's able to prove, through the testimony of a healthcare professional, that he is ready to resume the competent, ethical, and professional practice of law. And I think that the reason he was denied that and put a recommendation for a solid year was this conclusion, which we heard again today like a drumbeat, that he's...
Also, who would make the... go ahead.
Excuse me, did you say you would agree to an 18-month suspension?
Stayed.
Say stayed, or did you say actual?
No, we want an 18-month suspension stayed. Unless
okay.
He can't, on the condition that he goes to OLAP, does all the rest of the things that the panel recommended, and can come forward with an opinion from a healthcare
But we don't have an opinion as of right now in the record that he is...
There was not that opinion presented at the hearing. If the suspension was set to start in 30 days and we had an opportunity to submit evidence, we would be prepared to do that.
Mr. Johnson, in whose opinion would it be then that your client would be ready to return to the practice of law as a result of the treatment and the course of professional care that you're suggesting?
Judge Parker thought a lot of Dr. Beach, who was the independent physician. If you wanted to use him as a stopgap and have Judge Parker's healthcare professional interface with him, that would be acceptable. We are not trying to sneak him back into the profession. We are saying when he is able to prove that he's ready to return through
and
the
then,
testimony.
And then would he reapply to our court? Is that your idea?
That would be fine. Now, and I want to correct one other thing, if I could. Dr. Beach did not testify that this disease was not very treatable. He was encouraged. He said it can be chronic.
Pardon me?
He said it can be chronic.
Yes.
But he did say that the fact that Parker sought treatment himself was a good thing, and when asked when improvement would take place, he testified it may have happened already. So this isn't something it's not a death sentence. And, he functioned fine as a lawyer. The pressure and the responsibility of the bench perhaps made this come to fruition. He should be given an opportunity to return to the practice.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry.
Case submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye. Thank you.